Accession number 9202, block number 12.
Mr. George Ray, reel 12. Could you continue the story of the rape?
Certainly, certainly. I'm talking about this business of being over in the laying flat in the north, waiting for 0 hour. It seemed an interminable period. It was never ending. And yet it was only a question of minutes. And everything was deadly still and quiet. And in that period, I had time to think that behind us there were the trench mortars, the field artillery, which was comprised of 18-inch guns, field artillery, and from there, there's still the artillery, the 60-pounders, which was a very powerful gun. Further still, to the rear, there were six naval guns, which took care of the German lines, his communication lines, right back. And in the interval, that just passed through my mind, because I knew that was going to be the type of support that we were going to get. And we were getting a 10 minutes bombardment first before we had to move forward to go into the enemy territory. And at dead on 12 o'clock, the whole place was enveloped in gunfire. You know, it was terrific, absolutely terrific. Anyone that I can say now, it sounds very easy to say it now, but you talk about the fear of God. Anyway, preparing before we went over, we were given the option of wearing our ordinary peaked caps or the tin helmets. So mainly we went for the soft caps.
Why was that?
Because it wouldn't be so cumbersome. See, the tin hat. Anyway, there was one man whom we always used to look upon as Old Bill. He was always against the establishment and against this and against that, you see. But he chose to keep his tin hat on. And the funny thing happened was, a shell passed so close to him and his tin hat that it blew his tin hat off. And this took place just within that 10 minutes. However, when it ceased, the 10 minutes was up. It gave the gunners time to lengthen their fuses and to carry on, but from a further distance. And so we went forward, and I was with my section. Then we were supposed to go. And as far as I recollect, it worked just about what we expected it would do. And I and my fellow chaps, we went down into a bit of a dip, as a sort of a big cul-de-sac that the Germans had dug into the earth, like an earthworks, you see. And they were down there, they had been down there, at least if they were still there, they wouldn't last there very much longer, because we began firing our rifles, I did, into these cul-de-sac, these cat bivouacs that they had around, you see, in a sort of a horseshoe-shaped area.
Did you not have any bombs with you?
No. It was just a raid, actually. There would be people, perhaps, in another section with bombs or what have you. Anyway, there was a section was on the uppermost part of the ground, on the left side and on our right side. And the trouble arose, they wanted to know how it was, who it was that was creating all this din down below, you see, fire. Fortunately, they called out, someone called out and asked who we were before they did any firing. And I was able to call back my name. And that was all right. Otherwise, we would have been wiped out. Bombs or no bombs. And that saved us the day. Well, whilst this was happening then, further over to our left, they'd encountered a machine gunner, a German machine gunner. And he'd only fired one round before his gun jammed, fortunately. And they captured this man with him and his gun. And that was about all that they wanted, you see. It was evidence that they'd made this raid and they'd captured this chappie and any others, you see. And that was considered to be, well, part and parcel of the job to get to know a little bit more information. And one or two, we didn't have any casualties in our party, fortunately. But when we were ordered back and returned to our trench, there'd been more casualties in the trench that we'd left amongst the men who'd stood in as supports. More casualties in that case than we'd suffered outside in the open, you see, and in contact with the Germans. So anyway, we then got into our own trench, our trenches, and stood to for about an hour, waiting for any counterattack, but which never came. So after the counterattack, then we were relieved from the trenches and went back into support for the night. And I remember the Brigadier General being around, complimenting all the men on the night's work. See? So from then onward, there was a feeling of relief from the suspense. You see?
Where had this raid taken place? Whereabouts in the line was it?
That's just the point. I can't remember now. But I always seem to think it could be somewhere. it was more northern. It was more in the northern section. Not near Passchendaele, mind you. But it was somewhere. I still think it was somewhere near. Well, it was near the River Anc, you know. I said yesterday, didn't I? There was a period of calm when we all seemed to be taking things in the normal course of events. See? Nothing untoward happened. I think there was one incident which I could mention. We went to another section of the line, and of course all this was done at night time without any like to show where you were being put, stationed or whatever. Only we didn't go actually into the front line. We were more in reserve. And my section and myself, we were dumped in one particular spot and told to stay there. Well, which we did. In the morning, mind you, there had been some shelling at night time, because the Germans must have realised that there was a changing over, you see. Anyway, the next morning, as soon as it broke daylight, we discovered, to our disadvantage, much, we were stuck on an ammunition dump, and had been there right through the night, the hours of darkness. Well, you know, straight away, come on, up, out of this. Otherwise, as I say, we might have been blown sky high. Now, to return to this other question, if I told you that all leave had been stopped by the commander-in-chief, that was Dougie Haig, they even stopped leave to England in cases of death amongst family, anything like that. So, but there must have been some lifting of this embargo, because I was informed that I was going home on 14 days special leave because of the... It was my turn to go home, you see. And I looked on it as that. But then I thought, well, when you did anything that was supposed to be of any note, you used to say, as we used to say in France, they gave these honours out, military medals, you know. They always came up with the rations. We used to say that. Now, there were four section commanders, myself, and there was the Lewis gun section, because he'd refused to fire on the Germans on a certain preparatory to that raid that we made. He didn't get any mention at all. Because he didn't mind, because he didn't do it willfully, but he did it because he said it would be giving his position away, which it would have done, you see. Now, with my case and my section, I got hold of a couple of hand grenades on this event, and got one of the men who told me, on sitting on the firing step, that the Germans were mooching around, you know. I said, come on, we were around that traverse of the ditch to the next bay that was empty, and from there I threw my two hand grenades over, then duck, you know, and there was a bang on two occasions, and the same with this chap. And that was about all we knew about the Germans, because when I came back, well, there was nothing to be seen, but preparatory to that, I was always given to understand, to preparatory to this happening, you were not allowed to shave in the trenches, in the front line. But because it was summer time, I was having a shave in the front line, which was a bad example. If you wanted a bad example, It was a good excuse for many of them not to share it out, see, the conditions we were living under. However, when this chappie to me, hey, he said, Ginge, just first thing he came to, he said, Jams, Jerry's here, Jerry. Because he was looking through his periscope, sitting on the fire step, and looking through his periscope, and there's a couple of Germans, quite close, just over the top of the parapet, almost. And I did no more, with the face lathered with white soap, that white lather, but stick my head over the top. I don't know whether that scared them or but it scared me, because I was almost looking into the faces of two men, two Germans. And it was then that I straight round the trench. Now, for that incident, plus the incident of the raid that we made, there's a couple of military medals awarded. One didn't get anything. And I got my 14 days special leave to England. And after the 14 days special leave to England, had a jolly good time. Incidentally, the Germans followed me. Oh, I had to go to the brigade headquarters. And at the day that I went to the brigade headquarters for my cash, railway pass, and whatever, Foch, Marshal Foch, Lloyd George, and the Marshal Foch, Lloyd George, and there were three or four notable generals, and it was the time when they were going to make determined effort, because then it was, after suffering that setback that we'd had, we were beginning to find our feet and building up our artillery strength again because of the losses sustained, you see, previously. And on the way home, I went to the brigade headquarters to be greeted by one of the staff officers, and he said to me, well, how many did you kill? And I didn't kill any. I can't remember killing. I didn't kill any Germans. I don't know where he got that from, but anyway. Complimenting me because he thought I was going home because I'd been awarded some. But it wasn't that. It was because I was due for 14 days leave, you see. And on this, it was counted 14 days special leave. And that's what I had. So, on the way, at Etaps, we couldn't get into Etaps that night because of the bombing. And then from there, we went to Boulogne. We were stuck in Boulogne for a night. And then we got over the next day, over to England, only to be stuck in London there. And the bombing was nothing like what it was in the last war, of course. However, eventually I got home, had my fortnight special leave, returned to France again, and going up the line, back to the unit, I wouldn't be more than about, this would be July, it would be about July, it wouldn't be August, anyway, it would be sometime in July, when I took ill again with trench fever, and I went out the line and way down to the French hospital, an American hospital, one of these French hotels that are called pensions, you know, taken over by the Americans. And from there, of Dwayne.
You were quite badly ill then.
Well, the funny thing about it was, they couldn't get that temperature down. And, of course, the Americans then were just new to the war, at least where we were, in the hospital we were, because they didn't have a proper system of notifying particulars, taking particulars. You see, the people that were duplicating, you'd have a man come and ask what your religion was. Then another chap would come in and ask what your religion was. You'd be a Methodist with one person, a Church of England with somebody else. And that was the carry on. And in the end, the doctor would come in and he'd say to me, "I'll hand your name down to all posterity, me." And that stuck with me right up to today. I'm always handing anybody down to posterity, any time they do anything. But it was really very funny. There was a man there in this hospital, and he was ordinary diet. He didn't expect to get to Blighty, but he said he was going to try and get there. Well, I was on light diet, and he was on ordinary diet. And by some stroke of luck for him, someone wangled that I got the ordinary diet and he got the light diet. And still my temperature wouldn't come down. And that would be the cause of it, partly. However, they cleared us all out because there was going to be a big push. And once that was decided on, all the hospitals, any size or whatever, they cleared them, all the people out, conveniently close enough to England to get them across. And that's what happened to me. And when we got to the other side, I was asked on the hospital ship whereabouts I wanted to go, and I said Newcastle. Now, if I said Newcastle on time, I'd have been all right, and I said Newcastle, and they just put it down as Newcastle-under-Lyme. And so we went to Newcastle-under-Lyme, and that was that. And we got as far as in the train. And by the time we got to Stoke-on-Trent, instead of being in the beds, we were running about with joy and glee at the fact he had been back into in England, you see. However, get back into the beds, and one part of the station, Stoke, was close to other traffic because they hadn't had a hospital train in for quite a while, and it was a full train, believe it. And the number of men lined up, you know, VAD, voluntary detachment, and stretcher bearers, was a sight to see. And the people there were kindness itself. And eventually, I was taken to along with others, the Newcastle-under-Lyme, a hospital there. Actually, it had been a workhouse turned into a hospital. And the first floor, where they put me, it was on, they had to climb the stairs, which were like climbing a turret, you know.
Spiral
staircase, but all stone. And there were two chaps with me on the stretcher. And I insisted, I said, "Now, let me get off," I said. No, they wouldn't hear of me. They thought I'd been doing such a lot for them. And you know, I got, they carried me in, took me down the ward. There were only two of us in this ward. It was a big long ward too. Don't know where they put all the other chaps. But anyway, the man that was next vet to me, his name was Carr, he came from a colliery village outside Durham City. And I came from the county of Durham, but in another direction. And mine was more northerly, you see, towards Newcastle, you see. But there wasn't a great distance. There wouldn't be 10 miles difference. So, but we were together. And he spoke broad Durham, really. The nurses had to, they couldn't understand what he said. But they understood me, and that was sufficient. I was the interpreter for what this man said, you see. And ultimately, we didn't last there very long because of this difficulty with this man, Carr. And the complaints about the food that we were getting. For instance, if you came to dinner time, you always got the sweet before you got the main meal. See? And if you got the sweet, if it was rice pudding, it was served in a mug, workhouse fashion. And some of the men in the ward were men who'd contracted some sickness or other, but hadn't been to France. And whenever the doctors came round, they were always very poorly and sick, you know. They were fighting against the idea of having to go to France, you see. It was a sort of against fighting kind of thing, see? Conscientious objections. Couldn't get out to, they didn't want to go out to France, in other words. But to this chap and me, well, we didn't bother about anything like that. If a thing didn't, well, naturally, if a thing doesn't suit you, you tell them, don't you? Then, one day, this fellow Carr, I said, the nurse came, she said,